Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is August 20th. Well, I thought that the minutes from the Fed last night were really quite laughable because it just reminded me so much of the old pantomimes where you had somebody on the Punch and Judy show where somebody would say, "Oh, yes, he did," and then the crowd would retort back, "Oh, no, she didn't," or "No, oh, no, he didn't," and it was just back and forth. And this is very similar to what the Fed is doing, because what they're saying right now is that the massive amount of liquidity that they've added to the market does not amount to moral hazard. But it's curious to what they must think moral hazard means, because they basically came out yesterday and said, well, we don't think that yield curve control is a useful tool, that they're not really considering it, they're not ruling it out either, but that it probably wouldn't be very effective even if it was deployed. So yields went up a little on the news and they came right back down today, because nobody in the market truly believes that the Federal Reserve is serious when they make those sorts of statements. They know from vast experience over the course of the last more than 20 years, that whenever there's a problem, the Fed will step in and do whatever is necessary. And any kind of claims to the contrary are simply taken with a grain of salt. So, for example, when they say, "Oh, well, we're not engaged in yield curve control," well, then the market goes back and says, "Oh, yes, you are." We can see, for example, when we look at the yield curve spread, that every previous occasion when it became inverted, then it surged higher. And not just surged higher a little, but it went straight up towards 300 basis points. It hasn't done that on this occasion. In fact, it has been completely range-bound for more than 5 months already, and it's currently around 50 basis points. In fact, the yield curve is contracting again. But every time it gets up towards 70 basis points, it is knocked back in no uncertain terms. Now, generally speaking, what we would anticipate after a significant yield curve inversion would be that the yield would surge higher, because the Federal Reserve would belatedly accept that conditions have been too tight, that the economy is contracting. There would be a large differential between the short and the long end of the curve. That would be highly stimulative. It would encourage banks, or it would recapitalize the banks by creating that big interest rate differential. And then that would sow the seeds for a recovery. But usually in the interval between when we get to 300 basis points and that surge upwards from an inverted condition, that's usually when the stock market really experiences stress. And that's exactly, for example, what happened in 2007. It was around the time when we surged through the 50 basis point level that things started going pear-shaped on Wall Street. Then into 2008, they were already starting to cut interest rates. If we go back and think about the inversion in 2000, the market became, or the yield curve became mildly inverted in 1998, popped on the upside, and it came straight back down. Then it became really inverted in 2000. And subsequently, we had some very difficult times in the stock market until it eventually peaked. So it's the peak usually in the yield curve that has represented the lows in the market, or the end, the bear market. Now the question is this more like 1998, when we had a mild inversion and then popped on the upside and subsequently get a bigger inversion later? Or is this clear evidence that the market has concluded the Federal Reserve is in no way serious about avoiding yield curve control? But this is also very similar to the condition that we had with the repo market. The Federal Reserve had been decreasing the size of their balance sheet, raising interest rates all the way through 2019. That created a very illiquid environment in the repo market. They plugged $500 billion into the repo market as a stopgap measure. They completely denied that it represents a standing repo facility, but it's a de facto standing repo facility because investors have clear evidence that if there is a liquidity problem, the Fed will step in with as much funding as is required, and therefore it is a standing repo facility, regardless of whether they say it is or not. So it is exactly like this Punch and Judy show. It's exactly the same thing with buying corporate bonds. The Federal Reserve said, well, we're going to buy corporate bonds. And the market said, fantastic. So then they didn't have to. And the quantity of bonds that they have in fact bought is actually very small. But the corporate bond, liquid corporate bond markets, investment grade, rallied spectacularly on the news and are really only now experiencing some consolidation. Then when we think about pretty much any other portion of the market, the Federal Reserve said that they were going to buy a large number of bonds. They said they would buy $80 billion of treasuries and $40 billion of mortgages every month. But the size of the Fed's balance sheet peaked in June, and we're now in August, and they have not been buying that $120 billion a month. They don't have to, because they said they would. Everyone said, of course you will, but nobody really cares whether they are in fact doing it. So what we're in fact seeing today is that the market is behaving as if all these things have occurred when they have not occurred. And that can persist for quite a long time, but it's also representative of contradiction. And contradiction is exactly the kind of activity that we see in manias, because crowds are accepting of contradictions, because crowds are irrational. And that's one of the defining characteristics of irrationality, to look at a contradiction and to see fact, or to see evidence that something has occurred when it has not occurred. So we are in a very profound situation. Then, of course, we have the kinds of conditions that we now have in the stock market. So Nvidia, for example, it saw its data center business increased by about 54% in the second quarter. And they came out with guidance yesterday saying, well, we're not going to see anything even close to that growth in future, and we expect it to slow down meaningfully in the third quarter to approximately 10%. Well, the stock market briefly, and when I say briefly, it's extremely briefly, decided that that wasn't great news and then changed its mind. And within half an hour of the announcement, it had already recouped the decline and pushed on to new highs, or to a new intraday high. So we can certainly start to think about the massive valuations that we have on companies. The fact is that there is a backlog of orders for Apple. If you want to go onto their website and buy an iPad, well, then you have to wait 3 or 4 weeks before you'll get delivery. So they do have backlogged orders. And there is the potential that a lot of people will retool when 5G phones are released. But the valuation today is trading at 36 times earnings. And when we think about what that means in terms of the PE ratio, well, what we can definitely think about is that back only a couple of years ago, Apple was trading at a valuation of approximately 10, and that was certainly at 10 in 2013, but not far off it in 2016, and even in 2018 it was at 12. Today is at nearly 36, so the valuation has tripled. Now, obviously, the share has done spectacularly well, and it continues to do well, and the trend is still upwards, and the valuation now is at $2 trillion, which is an extraordinary figure. But $1 trillion was also an extraordinary figure, and it feels like a long time ago when companies crossed to that one. The reality is that we still have a consistent trend on the Nasdaq. It has a sequence of ranges, one above another. And we can also think about the fact that the size of the ranges is in fact getting smaller, and the length of time that they're spending ranging is shorter than the previous ranges. So the pace of the advance is picking up, and it's now unlikely that we're going to see a sustained move below 10,000 as long as this trend is continuing. It's the region of the upper or of the previous peak, and by the time prices get there, it'll probably represent the region of the trend mean. So 10,000 is now going to be a big psychological level for the Nasdaq. If it can hold the move above it, then we're still in a bull market. But if the Nasdaq starts breaking below 10,000, well, then we will have major inconsistency. It's the only major index that successfully bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average in March. But the price right now is approximately 50% above where the 1,000-day moving average is. So we've had a really spectacular move. And this move in bonds, this contraction in yields, the assumptions that the Federal Reserve is willing to do whatever it takes to inflate asset prices, because that's the measure they use for the success of their strategies. This is, I think, something that investors have clearly come around to understand, that it doesn't matter how much money has been printed. It doesn't matter how good or bad the economy is. What only matters is that the Federal Reserve's way of measuring the success of their strategies is in how successful they are in inflating asset prices. So that's almost money in the bank from the perspective of most investors. It's encouraging massively speculative activity. Now, to think that that's not moral hazard is risible, but that is the reality that we have. We have got these very clear momentum trends. Well, that also then has to be factored into how people think about gold. So the price did pull back sharply yesterday, and it was in positive territory in here today. We still have this consolidation underway. But against a background where we have clear momentum moves and the assumption, at least, of the expectation that there will be additional stimulative measures, then that should help gold and silver to have shallow reactions. Silver today was up about 17 cents, and it pretty much closed close to where it closed yesterday. So far, this low around the $25 area has held, and this looks like a range, but it doesn't look like anything more than a range. The reality is that gold and silver are still comparatively cheap compared to the valuations we have on other asset classes. They've only just started to move, whereas the trends that we have in bonds and equities are already very well developed. The lightning rod for the outlook for the US and for the dollar has to be the euro exchange rate. Europe so far has done reasonably well in terms of dealing with the crisis. They have also used the crisis as a catalyst to become more cohesive. So that's also a positive. But the euro now is at least steadying in the region of 118. Some consolidation below 120 was to be expected. And considering the fact that the Federal Reserve has printed approximately half of all the money created, or another way of thinking about it is that the USA has provided more liquidity than just about every other country combined, then it's rational that we should see additional weakness in the dollar. The pound today is beginning to play catch-up, and it was up over a cent, rebounding from the 130 area. And I think that is clear evidence now that we're starting to see support coming through in an area of previous resistance. It certainly needs to break up and through the 135 area in order to truly confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But the outlook here is that most currencies will trend higher against the US dollar. So far, the outlook for Asian currencies has been mixed. The Asia dollar index hasn't quite reached escape velocity just yet. It hasn't been able to break the sequence of lower rally highs yet. Part of the reason for that is because China has little interest in allowing the currency to appreciate meaningfully. It is appreciating versus the US dollar. But when we look at it, for example, against the euro, I think we get a better picture. The euro has clearly broken out against the renminbi. So even though the renminbi was somewhat stronger in here today, if the renminbi is going to hold its position of strength, and more importantly, if it were to sustain a move stronger than 8 against the euro, then that would remove a lot of pressure from other currencies in Asia. They'd have to compete against China in terms of manufacturing and exports, and therefore they are very sensitive to any efforts by China to devalue their currency. So that is certainly something to, I think, pay attention to. The Indian rupee was weaker in here today. It has been strengthening over the course of the last few months. The Nifty index had rebounded back above the trend mean. It was in negative territory in here today. The majority of indices in Asia were in negative territory. The H-share index is coming back down towards this 10,000 level, but I think that it's quite clear now that when we look at the Chinese market, every time it gets up to the peak, there is some reticence because there's a lack of overt government support at the upper side of the range, but there's certainly support at the lower side of the range. Well, as long as this range persists, it's going to help to unwind the overbought condition, and that then may set up the conditions for additional upside. But there's a lot of uncertainty going on in China, and not least that we still have extraordinary floods. When we think about the food security question in China, it's a big one. And U.S. Food commodities are still not breaking out. So China has not really been buying a lot. But if we think about food price inflation in China, it was really kicked off about a year ago. There was a heavy hail storm, or a series of storms, damaged the apple and pear crops. So that kicked off inflation in fruits and vegetables. Then we had the African swine flu, and that decimated the pork population, or the pig population. Then we had the swarms of locusts, and there were these stories almost like the Potemkin villages that China had vanquished the locust swarm by using drones, which is nonsense. But the reality is that these locust swarms have been ravaging crops right across China, the Indian subcontinent, and the Middle East and North Africa. Then we have floods, and the floods are having a significant impact on the Yangtze River Delta, and those are major crop-producing areas too. So these are significant issues for China. And then you also have the fact that Xi Jinping instructed the secret police in China to, and this is a quote, turn the knife inwards. In other words, to engage in a cull of potentially disloyal communist officials. So there are internal issues in China that represent risk that is in many respects unquantifiable. Of course, we also then had in Taiwan today that Taiwan Semiconductor pulled back rather sharply, and that has broken the short-term uptrend. You can clearly see that the downward dynamic stands out on the weekly chart as well as the daily chart. It has clearly broken the sequence of higher reaction lows. So now we're into some consolidation, and the region of the trend mean should hold. If it does not hold, well, then we're going to move into a much deeper and lengthier period of correction. So there is one thing about the stock market, despite the fact that investors have concluded that the central banks of the world are going to do nothing but print ad infinitum. We are at important areas of potential resistance in a large number of markets, so there is the potential for some consolidation. I think that it is more likely than not. We are, I think, already seeing that in some of the European markets that have paused in the region of their respective means. Then we also have Australia, which has paused in the region of its mean. The Brazilian market, in fact, I don't think that there's anything to be gained by looking at it in nominal terms because of the weakness of the real. So looking at it in an ETF, just in this case a pounds ETF, it has now clearly confirmed resistance in the region of the trend mean. And this chart looks completely different to the nominal price. So we can clearly then see that the vast majority of the stock market performance has been achieved by currency devaluation. One thing that is likely to be beneficial for Latin America is reshoring. A lot of the companies that are moving out of China in response to the trade war are setting up production facilities in Mexico. So that should be potentially beneficial for the Mexican economy. But the one of the challenges is that graft has picked up significantly with the new administration. But the Mexican peso is steadying up in here. Now, when we then think about some of the other factors, well, one thing that is particularly noteworthy is the resumption of interest in industrial resources. Copper prices have held the breakout from yesterday. The London Metals Index, which is the six industrial metals, has also broken its sequence of lower rally highs. But one thing that has not gotten any real coverage, as far as I can see, has been the fact that shipping prices have also have put in a higher reaction low. Now, when we think about the Baltic Dry Index, it is one of the only big indices that has retraced all of the commodity bull market. But we also had the new rules for the IMO 2020 introduced at the end or the beginning of this year. And that necessitated that every older ship had to have a scrubber introduced to the exhaust of the ship to reduce emissions. In many cases, the scrubber cost more than the ship was worth, so they were scrapped. And the Baltic Dry Index was breaking on the upside back in August, September of last year. Then it came rattling back down and bottomed sometime around May. Now, if this sustains a move above 2,000, and there's the potential that it will, considering that it's likely that 2021 is going to represent a period of global economic expansion. It wouldn't be difficult, considering the kind of contraction that we've seen this year. If countries engage in more infrastructure spending, and it's quite likely, I mean, if you think about the size of the floods in China, then roads are going to have to be rebuilt. There's going to be a lot of building to reignite economic growth. All of those industrial materials have to be transported to where the building is going to take place. That's a lot of shipping capacity, on top of the potential for more global trade on the back of synchronized global economic expansion. Well, with industrial resources rising, with ample liquidity all over the world and shipping prices potentially also rising, then we're either going to have an inflationary boom or we're going to have stagflation. I think the inflationary boom is much more likely, and not least because of just pent-up demand, because people haven't been able to spend or retool or rebuild inventories during the lockdown phase. So that does hold out the prospect that inflationary pressures will start to reappear sometime next year. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.